Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll remember Dorothy Harbach, who passed away last week. She was very active in the Dayton community, and we'll share some comments from some of her friends and associates. Sarah Buckingham reports on a group of volunteers and a housing project in transition. Later in the program, Politics Ohio. Up first, our continuing series, Soshi Talks. Each month on WISO Weekend, we hear from faculty and staff from area colleges and universities on a wide variety of subjects. It's a way to bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena and a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, our guest is Executive Director and Founder of Right Choice, Inc., Takiya Wright.
My name is Takiya Wright, and I am a proud graduate of Wright State University, or as I affectionately like to say, the Wright State University. As I reflect, I must say that the 6 years that I spent on campus were the best 6 years of my life. After graduating, I returned to my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, armed with 2 degrees, an undergraduate and graduate degree in business. I was ready to conquer the world. After going on interview after interview after interview, I kept yielding the same results. Nothing. I quickly realized that in order to change the outcomes for myself and other people that look like me, I would have to join the world of social entrepreneurship. I also began to appreciate the fact that my plan was not my purpose. Not familiar with the term social entrepreneur? In essence, we are a community of individuals who tackle major social issues, offering ideas for wide-scale change. Today, I am the executive director and founder of Right Choice Incorporated. Right Choice is a premier workforce development organization focusing on developing career-ready talent and promoting disability inclusion best practices in the workplace. For the next couple of moments, let's focus on best practices for our collegiate students with disabilities. Before there can be a successful transition from the campus to the workplace, there needs to be a solid foundation laid based on internships and experiential learning opportunities. Collectively, students with disabilities make up about 10% of the university landscape, but once they graduate, almost half of them remain unemployed, significantly populating the pool of untapped talent. When trying to identify a disconnect, one major factor is the lack of workplace experiences while in college. National research shows that a key predictor of employment success after graduation is student participation in experiential learning activities. Students with disabilities often do not participate in these critical experiences because many college campuses lack the knowledge and expertise to adequately prepare students for internship opportunities, support them during the experience, and educate employers on how to accommodate them, thus contributing to the high unemployment rate of our population of people with disabilities. In 2008, Right Choice partnered with Wright State University to pilot the UACT model. UACT stands for University Accessibility to Careers and Transition. The goal is to improve access and engagement in internship and professional development opportunities for students with disabilities on college campuses. This will be achieved through Right Choice, serving as a link between disability services and career services. The UAC model features a customized, student-focused approach, ensuring that we address disability-specific topics in career development. We do not believe in a one-size-fits-all approach to development. It is imperative that our students understand their value proposition, how to articulate it, and connect it to the demands of the workforce. Ohio has over 641,000 students enrolled in public universities, and well over 18,000 have disabilities, and that number continues to rise. We make a concerted effort to better position our students for postgraduate success, thus creating better outcomes. Right Choice wants to be a partner in the success for each student. My journey through life circumstances was merely a catalyst for change. Looking at the collegiate landscape as we know it, what measures are being put into place to create more successful outcomes for our college students with disabilities? If we tell our young people that education is their ticket for advancement, then experience is the key that unlocks the doors. If you want more information about Right Choice You Act model, please email me at youact@rightchoice, and that's WRIGHT choice.org. And remember to always make the right choice. Thank you.
Takiya Wright, Executive Director and Founder of Right Choice, Inc. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Now let's check in with Yellow Springs Home, Inc. Last week, over 30 bike and build volunteers rode into town to help Home, Inc. with a local affordable housing project. The same week, the organization transitioned leadership. After 10 years as executive director, on Friday, Marianne McQueen left the organization she helped build. WYSO's Sarah Buckingham has the story.
Yellow Springs Home, Inc. has rehabbed or constructed 10 homes in the last decade. But Marianne McQueen says Home, Inc.'s efforts to bring more affordable housing to Yellow Springs have been met with resistance from the very beginning.
Affordable housing is not popular anywhere. The bigger the project, probably the more controversial it'll be. That said, affordable housing in Yellow Springs is critical. I mean, it's a national issue. It's critical everywhere.
Land values in the village are $20,000 to $60,000 higher than the region overall. And McQueen says affordable housing is particularly important in Yellow Springs because of the aging populace.
I meet a fair number of young people, and a lot of those young people tell me, I really want to live in Yellow Springs, but I can't. And that's true of young singles just out of college, young families who are buying places in or renting in Fairborn, Xenia. We are an aging community, and I'm one of those elders now. And we have wonderful older people in Yellow Springs. But clearly, if the community continues to age as it does, and older people who are not working at a job are not paying into the village income tax, so that negatively impacts the village government, it's really critical for the village schools because our student population has decreased so much. So, an aging community is going to die. And it's critical that we have young people in our community.
And so why might someone be against an affordable housing development?
I think mostly fear. I mean, people will give different reasons. But I think underneath is fear, and there's still prejudice against ghettoizing, things like that. But my sense is neighbors who are concerned about property values, people who like to have a space the way it is and don't want to have it changed. We have had a lot of challenges, and it's very difficult to have an affordable housing organization in a very small community that's also very expensive. That has been fairly resistant to affordable housing. So I'm very proud that we have continued to exist.
McQueen says she's happy to leave the organization and feels Home, Inc. is in capable hands. Emily Siebel has taken over as executive director. She's been with Home, Inc. since 2009.
I think that in any community, anytime you're trying to build affordable housing, you'll run into a little bit of NIMBYism. In the business, NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. And in Yellow Springs, it's a close community, so everywhere is our backyard. And so oftentimes when you see who we're actually serving and who we're partnering with to provide opportunities for homeownership, it's probably very different than the perception you might have when you first hear the term affordable housing. My hope is that as we continue to deliver high-quality products and continue to partner with these wonderful families, that at some point we'll probably become a little bit more accepted. And the clients that we're partnering with, I mean, members of the PTA, nurses, hospice workers, artists, police officers, educators, administrative assistants. I mean, you're really looking at people who are working very hard, to invest in our community. And I think over time, that'll become clearer.
One of those clients is a local family with special needs. They've always lived in Yellow Springs and wouldn't be able to purchase a home here without Home Inc.
We're very excited about the West Davis Street project because it will result in the first fully accessible and affordable home that we've been able to provide here in the village of Yellow Springs.
Over 30 Bike and Build volunteers came to Yellow Springs to help with this project. Bike and Build is a nonprofit that organizes cross-country bicycle trips to support affordable housing around the country. The United Methodist Church welcomed the volunteers with a lasagna dinner. This group has been on the road for close to a month now. So far, they've built in Portland, Maine, Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Poughkeepsie, New York. Their final stop will be in Santa Barbara, California.
My name's Alicia Glover. I'm from Victoria, BC, Canada. We'll do anything from framing a house to landscaping to painting to cleaning out rivers and streams on a beautification day, picking up garbage, working on murals. So it's really whatever people need us to do.
I mean, we're one of the most powerful nations in the world, and yet every day people are denied the most basic right to shelter. And I think that that's just not right. So I want to be a part of that movement to change that.
My name is Anna Wilson. I'm from Akron, Ohio.
I'm Becky. It's just really important because affordable housing, like housing in general, is just like really important for you to have a stable home and like a stable life. And when you don't have that, it's like really hard for you to do like other things, like get an education, go to school, feed your family. And so housing is like the basis for what you can build a good life on.
The Bike and Build volunteers contributed 200 hours of work to Home Inc., rehabbing a rental property and doing maintenance on the West Davis Street project. Siebel expects to break ground there next month. Other projects coming down the pipeline include possible senior apartments, an eco-village concept, and even live workspaces for artists. Siebel says she's not planning to take the organization in a new direction. She believes in the mission of Home Inc.
Well, we believe that diversity does enhance a community. And I think that the community land trust as a model is uniquely suited to bring community stabilization to the village. And one of the reasons is because it encourages permanent affordability in the way that many models don't. And it also is really rooted in the relationship between this membership-based organization and the clients we're serving. Here in Yellow Springs, that means we're literally neighbors helping neighbors. And then when you're looking at land that is so scarce, developable land in Yellow Springs is obviously limited. To be able to provide something that will create a legacy that's intergenerational of affordability and inclusiveness, I think is a smart idea. And this is the time for Yellow Springs to plan for future generations. I think this is our moment. And I'm honored and delighted to be a part of making that happen.
For WISO, I'm Sarah Buckingham.
Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning on Why So Weekend. Last Sunday, Victoria Theatre Association Emeritus Board Member Dorothy Harbach passed away. Several friends and associates have expressed their sadness in Dottie's passing. Michael Rediger with the Victoria Theatre said Harbach was a wonderful spirit and said she was inspirational in the initial efforts to save the Victory, and the theatre would be forever indebted to her service and dedication. Kent Anderson was an executive at Reichs and the first managing director at the Victory Theater. He says Harbach was a major player in the Downtown Dayton Association and an active volunteer with many cultural organizations and events. Anderson also says that Harbach was the public relations face of Reichs Department Store in the 70s and 80s. He noted her efforts in helping build an active and vibrant downtown community and said Harbach loved the cosmopolitan feel of downtown. She loved the people creating that scene. The Victoria Theater in downtown Dayton has survived two fires and a flood, but in the early 1970s, it was threatened by a bad economy. Citizens rallied to save the Victory, and Dorothy Harbach and Fred Bartenstein were a part of that effort. They shared that experience with Miami Valley StoryCorps listeners.
In the early part of the 70s in Dayton, Ohio, there were some tremendous economic dislocations. The NCR Corporation laid off 15,000 manufacturing workers. They kept their world headquarters here, but they closed down manufacturing in Dayton. The Frigidaire Corporation, which at the time was a division of General Motors, closed entirely. Dayton Tire, Dayton Press had been closing within the 70s. And the WAGs had bumper stickers saying things like, "Last one to leave Dayton, turn out the lights." There was a great feeling of loss in the community. And that was the context in which tearing down the Victory Theater seemed like one more nail in the coffin of a dying city.
At that time, I was the marketing director for the Reichs department store, now Macy's. In fact, the main department store, the downtown store, was at the corner of 2nd and Main Street, which is just a block away from the Victoria Theater. Well, I was very upset about that because this had been such a part of my personal life. So I called a good friend of mine, Jean Capel, who was a newspaper writer. She had her own column in the Dayton Daily News, and we met for lunch, and we said, "What can two ladies do to save this great theater?" Well, the first thing that occurred to us is if we could just get them to hold off and not tear it down, that would be a substantial step. So we called, and the manager said he would see us the next day. His name was Jack Keyes, and he was very nice, and he didn't really want to tear down the theater, but he said, "You know, it cost me a lot of money for this empty building." So then Jean Capel right away wrote a column, and that got things going. And then she and I went around and talked to various groups and to some very leading citizens about saving the theater. The great philanthropists in the town at that time were not excited about saving it. They didn't think it was practical. But the people, the residents themselves, jumped on board.
People came out of the woodwork. One that I remember, and you may remember too, was a General Motors worker at one of the GM plants in Dayton. His name was Howard Selby. Howard Selby had just bought a car. He was an assembly line worker. And he was so excited about saving the Victory, he said he would go take a loan, a second mortgage, I guess, a loan back on his car for $1,000. And he would contribute that $1,000. That, by the way, was the largest single contribution we received to the Save the Victory campaign, with only one condition, that he would be allowed to sing on stage at the Victory Theater, which had been his lifelong dream.
Well, you know, saving the Victoria Theater just didn't save just that building, is what you were referring to. It saved a lot of other things. I don't think we would have the Loft Theater today if we hadn't saved the Victoria Theater. And the Dayton Ballet, which is the second oldest regional ballet in the country, now has their own rehearsal hall, and they perform it. They finally had a home.
Actually, the funny thing is that in 2010, we are in a strange way back to that same economic crisis coming out of the recession and another wave of industrial dislocation. Dayton has a crisis of confidence today that is very much like the crisis in the early 70s. But it's interesting to me that we lost many more manufacturing jobs in the early 70s and recovered from that than we've lost in the latest wave. Although
I think there's a new vision for Dayton, too. I think there are going to be more entrepreneurs, maybe smaller businesses, very scientific approaches. It's a whole different look.
Fred Bartenstein and Dorothy Harbach at StoryCorps in Dayton, Ohio. Dorothy passed away last week. Their conversation is archived in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and on the WYSO website at wyso.org. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of middle summer. This week, the Earth is wavering, balancing at its mid-year pause, vacillating between the high, excited birdsong of spring and early summer and the rhythmic, rasping chanting of late summer's katydids and crickets. And I wait in this quiet, expectant space. The third week of July, the 193rd day of the year, as the great pull of the sun reaches its limit and sways on the edge of the sky, then breaks apart among all the spent petals of the garden, folds into the darkening foliage of middle summer and the decaying strata of May and June. I look for cheer, for sense, and for meaning in old details, and I list the history of events around me, coming to terms with loss in its teaching. My favorites have been bloodroot and hepatica, red quince, mock orange, strawberries, raspberries, iris, honeysuckle, privet. And when I turn the listing upside down, where the past is still to come, my nostalgia goes away. The cycles are bound together, closed and tight, says the history of the flowers and the berries. Whatever is taken comes back again. Nothing ever leaves the circle or is left behind. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fifth week of middle summer. In the meantime, get up early to listen to the growing silence of the morning as the robins and cardinals end their summer songs.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and today I'm joined by Karen Kassler. She's the State House News Bureau Chief at Ohio Public Radio. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Glad to be here.
You reported this week on how the state budget has affected the Ohio Arts Council. It looks like the organization got more money, but there's some strings attached to that. So can you tell me what the budget says?
Well, the Ohio Arts Council did get more money than they were expecting. And advocates for the Arts Council are very pleased about that and say that they're grateful for the additional funding. But there was a provision that was entered into the Senate version of the budget, which dictated, basically, how the Arts Council could spend a $1 million federal grant it got from the National Endowment for the Arts. And the provision said that that money needs to be used for subsidies for artists and arts groups and communities and not for administrative costs. Now, on the surface, that sounds like exactly what this administration has been talking about and what makes sense, that the money should go to artists and arts groups. And indeed, the Ohio Arts Council does. Most of its job is giving money out to artists and arts groups and in these subsidies. But the Arts Council tells me that there are administrative costs that go along with education programs and research and things that require people to do jobs in the office and don't necessarily involve individual artists getting funding to produce their works. And so they're very concerned that this provision that was added in the Senate and made it into the budget would restrict how they can use their federal dollars, not state dollars, but federal dollars, and it might endanger some arts education programs and some other things that are in the works. You know, there are different rules on federal grants than there are on state grants and federal money versus state money. But the senator that I talked to, Senator Chris Widener of Springfield, who was on the Senate Finance Committee, said this is what we do in the budget process. Legislators have the authority to dictate how funds are used, and we even have the authority to dictate how certain federal funds are used. And so this is what we want to demonstrate to the Arts Council and other agencies, that money needs to go to the individuals who are supposed to be getting it rather than administrative costs. But then, you know, the Arts Council is saying on the other side that administrative costs are valid and do matter in many cases. So it's a continuing struggle, I think, here between where the money goes and who should actually get it, and it's a conflict that we're seeing a lot more here at State House.
And are there any other examples of this happening to other organizations in Ohio?
Well, the Arts Council says, as far as they're aware, they're the only state agency that has any sort of restrictions on its federal dollars like this, and they feel that they're unique in the nation, in fact. Now, you know, certainly there are rules on how money should be used in any department. I mean, Job and Family Services, education, all these agencies get federal dollars as well as state dollars, and there are rules on how that money should be used. But the Arts Council feels that it's unique in that this provision was put into their budget, and they don't feel that a similar restriction has been put into the budgets of other agencies. So they feel that, you know, while they're grateful for the extra state dollars, they feel that this restriction could eventually be a concern.
And certainly there are other organizations that get federal money. And I'm just wondering, when you talked to the folks involved, did they have any inkling to why perhaps the Ohio Arts Council was being singled out in that way?
Well, I think there's an idea, and, you know, this is not necessarily a partisan idea, that people want money going to the individuals who are in programs. You know, you want your money going for food banks to go to buy food to serve people. When you're looking at welfare programs, you want the money to go to recipients and not to administrative costs. And that issue, administrative costs versus services, but unfortunately those two things are pretty closely tied. There's a segment for my television show, The State of Ohio, this weekend, where I'm talking to some people who are in the safety net organizations about this idea of too much money being spent on administration. But administrative costs are very, very important in determining who is actually eligible for programs, who should actually get the money rather than who should not get the money. And it takes people and administrators to figure out eligibility, to figure out who should get grants, to figure out which artists should get funding that goes to arts agencies. And so it's this idea that administrators are just people who push paper around. There are a lot of folks who are pushing back on that, saying that's not true. They're actually making sure the programs run as people want them to be run.
We mentioned a little bit about what impact that this would have on the Ohio Arts Council, but what impact will it have on other state organizations that are involved in the arts?
I'm not sure. I think the Arts Council is still fleshing this whole thing out. The Arts Council is now looking at the programs that were getting some money from this NEA grant, I think, and trying to figure out what can we do now to keep these programs going, because that's obviously what everybody wants to see happen, is programs that were in place or planned, they want to see those programs continue on. And so I think it's kind of one of those wait-and-see things to figure out exactly what happens and who will be affected in the long run.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State and House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. You may have noticed that we were off the air for a couple of days last week. That was the result of two direct lightning strikes, one to the YSO transmitter and one here at the station. The full extent of the damage is still unknown, but the damage includes computers and electronic components in all three of the station's studios. Right now, we've got two studios back online, and a temporary antenna has been installed. Our engineers Jim and Russ have been incredible in their efforts to get us back up and running. Right now, we're operating at a slightly reduced power output until we can get a permanent antenna installed. We've had a great show of support from our listeners, and we appreciate that. We've got photos of the lightning strikes and additional information on our website. And just a side note, if you didn't notice we were off the air last week, you really need to listen more often. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Doc Hour.
Tonight, Destination DIY continues with a look at what happens when you think of the economy as a do-it-yourself project. This week's episode includes stories about local currency as a form of marketing for one small town, how kids learn to barter on the playground, and saving money without a bank. Host and producer Julie Sabatier hopes you'll feel optimistic about money for a change. That's coming up on Destination DIY tonight at 6 p.m. Then at 11 o'clock, it's WTF with Mark Maron. This week, Mark's sitting down with Robin Williams. So what do you talk about with an international comedy superstar? How about alcoholism, cocaine, divorce, joke stealing, heart surgery, fame, Richard Pryor, jealousy, and Twitter? Tune in for a brand new episode of WTF tonight at 11 o'clock right here on WYSO.
Coming up next on WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.